This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and this is episode 2. Thank you all so much for your support and for tuning in to the first episode of the podcast. I want to thank Ian Castle again for the interview and sharing his experience and insight into microcap investing. This week on StockNewsNow.com, we featured articles highlighting video interviews with the following companies: BioLargo Inc., BLGO on the OTCQB, Provectus Biopharmaceuticals Inc., PVCT on the NYSE market, Rights Corp Inc., RIHT on the OTCQB, and Anavex Life Sciences Corp., AVXL on the OTCQX, and the Metals Weekly wrap-up with the Morgan Report. Go check those out if you haven't already done so. We also published a Wall Street View with Brent Cook, editor geologist of Exploration Insights, an online newsletter publication. You know, we've spoken to Brent many times over the years about investing in the junior mining exploration sector. And in this interview, he and Shelley discuss how to invest in junior mining when commodity prices are at or near all-time lows. What I like about our interviews with Brent is that he is a geologist. And something I took from our last episode with Ian Castle is that you want to know everything about the company you may invest in. And for a sector like exploration and junior mining, how is this possible? However, I've been lucky enough to attend many mining and resource conferences and met a lot of people who have helped me understand the junior resource sector who were not geologists. One such individual that I connected with was Nick Hodge, editor-in-chief of the Outsider Club, who is my next interview on the Planet Microcap Podcast. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 2 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Nick Hodge, and you won't want to miss the latest Ask Mr. Wall Street following the interview. But first, a word from our sponsor.
A comprehensive streaming of market data, research, and portfolio management application for you. QuoteStream is a real-time streaming quotes and research system designed for the day trader, retail investor, institutional investor, both new and old. QuoteStream offers low latency, tick-by-tick data, advanced charting, comprehensive technical analysis, news, and research. With no software to install and no servers to maintain, QuoteStream is the ideal solution for you. Go to StockNewsNow.com and start your free 7-day trial. Click the QuoteStream banner in the header or real-time quotes in the nav bar to get started building and managing your investments.
So for this interview, I wanted to speak to Nick Hodge. And the reason is because I've covered a lot of mining conferences in the last few years where we met. And he developed his own investing strategy while starting out as a beat reporter in clean technology. I wanted to talk to him to get a better understanding about what it takes to invest in natural resources from someone who's not a geologist. He's also 31 years old and has been on the beat since 2006. And with that, I'd like to welcome Nick Hodge to the program. Nick, welcome.
Good morning, Bobby. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to do that.
Dude, me too, man. I'm excited to have you on. Before we get down and dirty into the gold pit, so to speak, let's start off with a little background about you and how you came to be.
My name is Nick Hodge. I run a free newsletter called The Outsider Club. I obviously didn't always do that. The Outsider Club's only about 2 years old. And I've been in this industry, as you said, for about a decade thus far. Started in around, late 2006, early 2007. But then, I was just a kid out of college, right? I had a degree in advertising and writing communication, but I really had no direction, didn't know what I was doing. And so I took a job as a research analyst and assistant editor at Angel Publishing. And I just really took to it, right? I took to analyzing stocks and writing about stocks in a non-technical way for a general retail audience, an average Joe, if you want to call it that. And I'm certainly an average Joe. So that was really became my mission, right, to decode, demystify the stock market. And as it happened, my original beat that I was assigned to was clean tech. So I got to know a lot lot about the solar space and the wind space and the energy space in general, going on to write a book in 2007, 2008 about investing in renewable energy, and then on to sort of master the energy space in its entirety, culminating with an Energy Investing for Dummies book in 2010, 2011. So I really cut my teeth on the energy sector, and then sort of, you know, jumped from there into other resource sectors, which I think is a natural leap, especially once you get into, you know, things like coal and uranium. They're all those are energy minerals, and then from there I jumped to other minerals. It's just sort of the hard asset space that I like, right? Something real, something tangible. But as far as how I got here, it was really answering an ad, right, for a research analyst and writer nearly a decade ago, and then just building a knowledge base and a network from there.
Before we get into really, you know, the technical or the non-technical approach to investing in basic materials, energy type companies, you know, how what did you do? When you're at Angel Publishing, they assign you to clean tech, you start writing about energy, you know, what is it that you did when you first started that you looked at that you're like, okay, I'm going to use this as my resource, as my, you know, my base, and then I could probably learn from here. Did you go and read a couple books? Was there somebody you subscribed to? You know, how did you do it?
So at a very basic level, I was in over my head, right? And so I needed to get a knowledge base of clean tech and energy very quickly. So the places I started, I mean, we're talking, you know, very initially now, like the first things I started reading were EIA reports, right? IEA reports. I'm talking about, you know, the Energy Information Administration for the United States, and then the International Energy Agency for the world. You know, reading the reports about, you know, what's installed already, right? What is the world's energy mix? What percentage is coal? What percentage is oil? What percentage is natural gas? And what is the mix in different countries? And where does it come from? What are the top 10 producing oil states, the top 10 producing natural gas states? And then really just from there going into other aspects of policy, right? What is the United States energy policy? What is the Canadian energy policy? What are the subsidies that are being offered, or the land that is being given under the Bureau of Land Management? How do those leases work? And then from there, you know, learning about the biggest players and what they're doing. And then so that comes going to conferences. So I would go to as many conferences as I could. I would get in with a press pass, and I would go to, you know, solar energy industry association conferences, SEIA conferences. I would go to SEPA conferences, solar energy photovoltaic association conferences. I would go to wind conferences, and I would just, you know, meet people, sit in sessions, talk to executives, try to talk to policymakers. You know, and these are my early years, right? I'm just a kid who doesn't know much, but I got to meet, you know, T. Boone Pickens, and I got to meet Ted Turner, and I got to discuss, you know, some of their energy investments with them just by hanging out at these conferences and these different industry events. So I think immersion is key, right? It's just like learning a new language. You can study it at your desk, and you can read in Italian all day long, but unless you go live in Rome for 3 months, or you go live in an energy conference for 3 months, then that's really the way you're going to pick up the stuff and be able to discuss it fluidly and fluently.
You're so right. You know, you listen to these guys and you really take in a ton of information. But you brought up an interesting point when you first, like the very first initial thing that you looked at. And I think that's kind of key when you're considering the first approach from a non-technical perspective. And that is, you analyze the government policies around the world with regard to basic materials and resources. When you first took in that initial information, you know, how did you categorize it in your mind? You know, was it something where you're like, okay, these are the countries where there's a little bit of political instability, this is a potential opportunity, these are the countries that, you know, it's more stable, you know, these are the resources that they're producing and exploring for, these are the places that, you know, they haven't really maximized their exploration potential? You know, how did you categorize it?
Oh, absolutely. So again, this was through the lens of clean tech, right, in its heyday in 2007, 2008. So I would identify, you know, who had the most robust, you know, subsidy schemes and regimes, right? At the time, it was Germany that was offering a generous solar subsidy. So the obvious way to go invest in solar was through, you know, German manufacturers and cell and module producers. At the same time, we also saw a big push to reduce carbon emissions, right? So there was various carbon reduction schemes in Europe. Europe, and I would look at companies that were getting or selling carbon credits, basically on new exchanges that they had created as a new form of, you know, revenue generation. Not only are they installing a clean tech asset or an asset that reduces their energy consumption, thereby reducing carbon, you know, like heat from wastewater or wastewater recycling or something like that, and then getting carbon credits from that. So I would look for, you know, different sorts of new markets that were being established then. And look for companies that were going to profit because of that. At the same time, you know, shale was coming online. So I would look to see what the DOE was saying about, you know, the Bakken in North Dakota to see, you know, what the potential reserves that they thought were there and then the companies that were going to get it. So, yeah, it was very much looking at the overall, you know, the broader movement in world energy markets, but then seeing which countries in particular were making, you know, moves on certain sectors or policy decisions to make a certain sector more beneficial than another. For example, in the U.S. back then, we had solar energy credits, and the big debate or the big worry among energy investors then was, when are these credits going to end, and is the policy going to be extended for another year to get, you know, a solar tax credit for another year? And the stocks would really move on that, right? If it was thought that the tax credit would be allowed to expire, then, you know, solar stocks would become a sell. And when it was announced that, you know, some committee or the Senate was voting to extend them or that they were going to be renewed, then that was a buy catalyst. So, you know, these things went hand in hand with the market, especially in a clean tech market that was so nascent that needed, you know, the training wheels of governments around the world.
Let's say, okay, you did your research. You're looking at, right now, you know, the last couple months you've been writing about uranium for the website. You talked a little bit about palladium too in the magazine. And, you know, let's say there's a junior mining company that's exploring for uranium in one of these countries. You know, what are the different catalysts that you're looking for?
Well, two things jump to mind. First is you take a macro approach, just as I described for when I first, you know, started dipping my toes into this world. And by that, I mean, you look at all the macro factors in the uranium space. What is uranium trading at per pound? What has it been trading at, you know, over the past 5 years or the past 10 years, and try to establish a pattern and see if you can establish a cycle, because I truly believe these markets are cyclical. And then you look at, you know, what's going on inside the world of uranium and nuclear generation, right? Which countries are building and adding? Which countries, if any, are taking away? Were there any, you know, major past catalysts that you can look to and see why they were a catalyst historically and if they could, you know, become a catalyst again? With uranium in particular, the most recent big event was obviously the Fukushima disaster that, you know, sent uranium prices from over $100 a pound down to in the mid-20s. So you look at all these macro factors, right? The same as I read policy reports for clean tech, I start going to the, you know, the World Nuclear Council and seeing who is building new nuclear reactors and who is building them, right? And where is the uranium going to come from? What does the fuel cycle look like? How much uranium is coming from mine supply versus secondary supply? And by that, I mean, you know, decommissioned warheads and things like that. And so you just really got to get in tune with the macro picture and try to embed yourself in the cycle and say, okay, where are we at today? Where have we been? And where do I think we're going? And why? And I'd be glad to talk about some of those things, why I think the uranium sector is going, but I'm not quite sure that's what you're after at this point. So the second thing I would say, in addition to immersing yourself in the macro situation, is to leverage a network, right? And I know not everyone can do that, because not everyone has spent, you know, 10 years in the resource business writing about it. But if you go to some conferences, you know, speak to the speakers afterward, get their card. You mentioned, you know, we're not geologists. No, and I'm certainly not a geologist, but I have several geologists' cards in my Rolodex, right? So if I see a project or a company I'm following does put out a resource estimate or a preliminary economic assessment or a feasibility study, I can email that geologist that I have a rapport with and say, hey, what do you think about this document? What do you think about this asset? What do you think about this drill hole? What do you think about the economics of this project? And so you have to create and leverage a network or find someone who can do that for you and be willing to learn, be willing to say, you know what, I'm not a uranium geologist. I'm not a uranium expert by trade, but I can read as much as I can to become, you know, a jack of all trades of uranium, and then find some real experts in the sector that that you can leverage even more to gain more knowledge, more specific knowledge about individual companies or individual assets or what's going on behind the scenes, right? I have a gentleman that's the CEO of a uranium producer, and whereas, you know, I can't get with the simple click of a mouse, you know, what are the last couple utilities that have entered the spot market to purchase for the next fuel cycle? He can tell me that. He can say, you know what, Nick, Exelon entered the market earlier this year. They're the largest nuclear utility in America, and they're now entering the spot market to buy for the 2017-18 cycle. Well, that's not something you can find from a Google News search or a Google search in general, right? That's something somebody has to tell you because they know it, because they're inside the industry. And I think that's very important.
I got a two-part question now. And it kind of has to do a little bit with the last interview that I just did and also with something that you said regarding conferences. So how did you, especially when you first got started, because I know, you know, when I was first there, you know, I was 22 years old and just
sure.
Hearing, you know, these guys are quite charismatic. So you're just like, oh my gosh, the world is going to come to an end. I got to load up on gold and silver and, right. You know, I got to do this right now, you know, but through time, you start to kind of realize, okay, calm down. Let's really analyze the situation here and figure out what's going on. So for you, what was that experience like for you, and how did you manage what others were saying that were very strong proponents? And then the second part of my question is, you know, using uranium as an example or any junior mining company or sector, how do you analyze management?
Sure. Well, to the first part of the question, I have a couple of answers. I think, first of all, you're going to take your lumps, right? The CEOs that are giving these presentations, if it's about an individual company as opposed to, you know, an analyst or a specialist in a sector that's talking about more macro, you know, the CEOs, their company is always the best company in the world, right? It's always the stock you should be buying now. And so that's the story they're going to present on stage, and that's what their slides are going to be about. And you're right, they're very charismatic. They're salesmen by nature, and it's very easy to buy into those stories. And so I think originally you're going to take your lumps. You're going to make some missteps. You're going to buy into things that you shouldn't have bought into, or you're going to, you know, buy a stock at the wrong time because someone told you to, where in reality, you know, some restricted shares are about to come due and insiders are going to dump on your buying, things like that. I mean, those are just mistakes you learn from, and you take your lumps and you try not to make those mistakes again. And that's if the mistake is your own part, right? You bought into something. And then, you know, some guys are perpetual, like you say, either schmoozers, I don't want to use the word con artist, but they use public companies to fund their lifestyle, especially on the venture exchange in Canada, right? And so, you know, I have a strict fool me twice policy. The first time it's my fault, but, you know, if you lie to me again or you tell me about a bad deal again, or you tell me about a deal just so you can make an exit or something like that, then, you know, I lose your card, I lose your phone number very quickly. So you just have to find the right people. You have to keep talking to the ones who give you good information and good tips and good analysis, and you have to stop talking to the ones who don't. And here's a real clear example. I have to go back to clean tech, but those solar stocks were going up, you know, 10% a day, literally, in 2007 and 2008, right? And solar analysts and solar CEOs were saying, you know, this is going to the moon. Solar is, you know, the next big thing. And I still agree that it is, but, you know, you had the 2008 financial crash. You had the cost of polysilicon plummet off a cliff, which no one saw coming in 2008. And then you saw, you know, stocks that were $50, $60, $70, $80 or more quickly trading for, you know, under $5 or less. And so I think that just experience is what comes along with that, being, I don't want to say jaded, but definitely a little bit cynical, and definitely taking everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about just taking in as much information as possible. And yeah, I mean, you said it, man, you know, you're going to take your lumps.
Yeah, for sure. And I've taken mine, and I'll probably still take a couple more. I mean, you alluded to it earlier, but we're still young guys. I think we're about the same age. I'm 31. So definitely still learning. Definitely have to admit that you don't know everything, and just have to be receptive as possible to the most quality information. And I can't speak highly enough about just creating a good network of mentors and peers that you can, you know, talk about stocks and discuss things with, and especially gentlemen that have been in the business longer than you and have seen more than just the last cycle that we've seen, but have seen, you know, cycles since the 70s and 80s. And I think seeking those people out and befriending them, and many of them are more receptive than you think. I mean, they love this stuff. They love rocks. They love investments. And so if you can find a couple people like that to feed you ideas and sort of mentor and coach you a little bit, that comes a long way. And that goes right into your next question about analyzing management, right? I think the first thing you have to do, and this is something I picked up from hearing Rick Rule speak a lot, is, you know, you have to make sure they're doing something they've done before, right? If you have a guy trying to bring a gold asset into production in Mexico that's only brought a rare earth element project into production in Sweden, then, you know, where's his skill set for gold in Mexico? So you have to make sure, and I think this is key, is make sure they're doing something they've done before. You don't want someone who is green. You don't want someone who doesn't have the specialty that's needed for the current project at hand. That's the first thing. The second thing is you want to look to someone that's had success. You don't want to look for a serial CEO that's jumped around to stocks or companies that never went anywhere or never made any profitable exits, not just for themselves, but for shareholders as well. So you want to look for a positive track record. And then beyond the information that you can find out just from doing research on those individual names, you have to go back to your network, which is why I said that was a perfect lead into this question, right? You have to go to one of your mentors or one of your people that you talk to and say, hey, what do you know about this guy? Have you ever worked with him? How does he treat shareholders? What do you think his priorities are? And I think that goes a long way. I mean, they say women talk, but I think men in the resource business talk more. And so you really have to, talk to people.
Where do you go to find your new ideas for companies that you may be interested in? And two, you know, do you have any books or recommended reading that, you know, our audience or people who are just getting started investing in resources and energy?
Sure. I think you have to read general securities books, right? So you know, first of all, how to approach a stock. We're talking about books like, you know, Security Analysis or The Intelligent Investor. Those are, I think, solid reading, foundational reading for any resource investor. And from there, I think you need to maybe take some online courses. I've definitely done this for myself, some like free Geology 101 courses to learn what, you know, what grades are, to learn what how different resources are quantified in the ground. What is a measured resource? What is an indicated resource? What is an inferred resource? That can be a textbook, but it can also be, you know, a free online course. There's plenty of things for learning those types of skills online. And companies will send you things as well. I mean, companies, their IR departments, they want you to be educated. They want you to understand the things you're investing in. And so sometimes I'll hit up a copper company and say, hey, is there any foundational or seminal reading you can send me about, you know, copper mining or the copper resource market? And they're more than glad to do that. So again, leveraging the network as much as possible. And I don't know about resource books individually. Most of the books I've read are like in the water space, because I like that space as a resource as well, like Water Wars and things like that. So, I think online courses, and increasingly they're offered for free, are a great place to go.
Cool. And to the first part of the question, you know, where do you go to find new ideas or to check in on old ideas, for new news or information?
Well, conferences is the number one, right? I mean, you guys put on a fantastic conference in Vegas this year. There were some new ideas there. And not just the companies that are presenting, right, but people you run into at the, you know, the refreshment bar or at a breakfast, or people that approach you, you know, in the exhibit hall. I think conferences are by far the place I get the most new ideas. Other than that, there's two other places. So one is just good old-fashioned legwork and research. I spend several hours a day just, you know, reading and researching the sectors of the market I'm interested in. And just by doing that alone, I see new things all the time. And then going back to the network, which I think is very, very crucial, people will tell you about things, right? Because other people know things that you don't. And so one time you tell somebody about a stock that they haven't heard of, and the next time, you know, you get an email, hey, have you seen this deal? Have you seen this company? So I think those three things are definitely the primary places I get new ideas: conferences, my network, and good old-fashioned research.
All right, Nick, so we're about to wrap up here. Give yourself a plug. Where should people go to find out more information about the one and only Mr. Nick Hodge?
You can go to outsiderclub.com. There's a free newsletter there, published 6 days a week. Plus, we also do a couple extra articles a day. You'll find most of the resource market covered there, and also a lot of other things outside the resource market, specifically, income generation and dividends. So we have a pretty wide focus, and it's not just me. We have several other editors, including Jimmy Mangle, who's running a publication for us, and we just got Jim Collins, who is an asset manager on Wall Street. So we're definitely growing, and we're definitely constantly, growing the amount of content and the specificity of the content. So check out OutsiderClub.com for sure.
And where can our audience find you on Twitter?
Oh, at Nick C. Hodge. So just my name with a C in the middle, Nick C. Hodge.
That's H-O-D-G-E. Okay, everybody. I'd like to thank Nick for coming on to this episode of the Planet Microcap podcast. Nick, it's always a pleasure, and thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you soon at an upcoming event and maybe coming back on the podcast soon.
I agree, and thanks for having me as well.
All right. Take care. Have a good one.
You too.
I'm Shelley Kraft, and thank you for listening to Ask Mr. Wall Street. Today's question is, as a former investment banker, what is the due diligence process like, and how does it differ from the due diligence process of a private investor? Investment bankers are a clearinghouse of company facts, figures, future potential, valuation, but most of all, how does the management team of the company plan to use the investor's capital? This is called use of proceeds. The process of determining pre-money valuation of the company is a negotiation between the issuer and the banker, with the issuer pulling for the most money for the least amount of shares, and the banker pulling for investor value, upside stock price increase potential in the aftermarket. Determining the after-money valuation is a great deal easier and determined by the liquidity and buy side of the aftermarket buying, which determines the valuation given by investors. For example, a company is priced by investment bankers at $5 per share, and it closes the first day of trading at $6 per share. The after-money valuation is higher than the pre-money valuation of $5 per share, which is great for investors and also means the investment bankers were fair with the issuer on determining the price. The due diligence process of an investment banker carries very harsh results and sometimes penalties if they don't look under every rock for potential problems, including full background checks on all investors, directors, insiders, and private placement investors. Investment bankers retain outside professionals to engage with the issuer's counsel and CPA firm to verify the essential documents before the company can receive any capital. This due diligence process takes at least 90 days and oftentimes longer if oddities need correction and to answer SEC comments. In general, the investment banker due diligence process provides an accurate assessment of the company, including full disclosure, with a centric focus on providing a company's financial MRI. Investors' due diligence is so much easier. The process begins by reading what is provided by the investment banker and public information provided by the issuer via the company website, EDGAR, FINRA, and press releases. Investors should dig deep for information, as it is said, the deeper you dig, the greater your due diligence. Also, as an investor, you should have access to research and comps of other companies such as competitors, access to trade magazines, analysts' reports, Scuttlebutt, and of course, StockNewsNow.com.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Nick, again for coming on to the program. What I learned this week was the importance of developing your network, coming up with as many questions as you can about the company, industry, or sector you're interested in investing in, and doing your best to try and find those answers. You can access the podcast by going on to StockNewsNow.com under podcast, go to Podbean.com and search Planet Microcap Podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap Podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, where we'll have our next week in review, answer a new question from Ask Mr. Wall Street, and have another exciting guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast or for Ask Mr. Wall Street, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.